Hello, welcome to Eyes for Ears, your ophthalmology OCAP support of you podcast. We're your hosts, Ben Young.
And Amanda Redfern. Remember, this podcast is for educational purposes only and not to diagnose that weird thing on your eye.
Each week we take a high-yield topic and talk about the why and the how. What are we talking about this week, Amanda?
We're talking about VKH.
What does that stand for?
Oh, God.
I say VKH.
You gave me the hard one.
I know. The hardest part of the test. VKH.
I think, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, it's Voigt-Koyanagi-Harada syndrome.
Yeah, exactly.
Much easier to say VKH.
It's pretty rare bilateral granulomatous panuveitis, but I feel like there's a lot of very distinct things that are testable. So I think it's a good topic to go over on its own. We did cover this briefly when we did, it was like one of our earliest episodes, the white dot syndromes episodes, but I think it's a big enough and complicated enough disease that it's worth going on over in its own episode. So here we are.
Totally agree. So interestingly, what I didn't realize before this episode is that it's actually two syndromes put together. Do you want to talk about what I mean by that?
Yeah, this is a terminology thing that I don't think like is universally accepted, actually, but to me, it's helpful. So, you know, when we talk, when this is, I think, how it's addressed in the BCAC textbook, most people go by VKH, Voigt-Koyanagi-Harada syndrome, as being a distinct bilateral granulomatous uveitis that also has like characteristic systemic findings, which we'll go over. But some people term Harada syndrome as only the ocular findings. Like it's the same disease, but without the systemic things that we're going to go over. I know in my fellowship, we use this terminology, but I haven't seen it universally. So, you know, that's how some people distinguish between like VKH is uveitis plus systemic findings, and Harada is like only the very characteristic ocular findings, the uveitic findings. Anyways, I think before we go into what those findings are, it's like really helpful because I'll tell you, it will seem like a random collection of things, but I think it's helpful to understand what we think is the underlying pathophysiology, and I think that'll make everything else make sense. So do you want to give us the basics of that, Amanda?
Yeah. So the way I like to think about this is the body is basically unintentionally or intentionally waging war on pigment. And what we think is the underlying pathophysiology is that there's a T-cell mediated autoimmune reaction to one or more antigens that are associated with melanocytes or melanin or basically pigment. And that includes reacting to the RPE. It does have an HLA association with DR4, which is testable, but not something that I would think to be ordering in clinic.
Yeah, with like the HLA testing, that's just the DR4 is one I memorized for, you know, when I was, you know, preparing for boards and such. But there's a number of other ones that are like DR15 has also, you know, been associated with it. There's a number of other ones. But, you know, I think it's just useful if you're ordering HLA testing anyways because you're trying to rule out other things. If you don't know exactly what's going on, be aware that DR4 has been associated with it.
In terms of epidemiology, I think understanding that pathophys helps to kind of picture what type of patient you might more commonly see that in, and that would be people who are pigmented. You can tell by the name that it was first described probably in Japanese populations, and it's more prevalent over there. But other races or ethnicities with pigment are more likely to present with a VKH than someone who is Caucasian and has less pigment, although that's not a 0% either.
Yeah. And I was just curious about this. Voigt, you know, Koyanagi and Harada, I imagined they were like a bunch of buddies that saw a bunch of these patients, are like, hey, let's write up this paper. But they like all just discovered it independently or described it independently. And then someone else was like, oh, these all sound like the same thing. So let's just like unify the name. So they're not all friends. I thought they were all like drinking buddies.
You know, props to the person who put it all together, because I'm guessing it was in different literature.
Yeah.
What they were looking at was completely different, like in terms of systemic findings, noticing that there was CSF pleocytosis. And I'm pretty sure the average ophthalmologist working up panuveitis is not often getting lumbar punctures and looking at their CSF. So it had been reported pretty separate in the literature.
Yeah.
And to put that together is pretty cool.
Yeah. By like, you know, in different like decades and such. But then, yeah. Someone was like, yeah, it's like the same thing. Just go with it. okay. Anyways, that's, I think, enough about. So, I mean, hopefully the rest of this is clear that VKH is basically like melaninitis. It's just inflammation where you have pigment. And it happens, your eye has a lot of it. So let's go over what the actual clinical manifestations are. There are kind of four stages that we want to think about or know about. Do you want to tell us what the first stage is, Amanda?
So the first stage is the prodromal stage. And this is typically non-ocular symptoms that might resemble like a viral type of illness. You can get headaches, fever, nausea, dizziness. So these symptoms are related to the autoimmune insult to the melanin. And there's surprisingly melanin all over your body, including in the middle ear, which I was surprised about. So symptoms also include tinnitus and dysacusis, which is pain related to sound. It's fascinating when you read into theories about why we get tinnitus. Often we think about tinnitus as something that is wrong with your hearing or inside your ear itself. But I was reading about the theories, and in particular related to this, that if there is injury to a part of your eighth nerve, it's more so that your brain is misinterpreting the signals from that injury and your brain is making up that tinnitus sound.
Yeah, no. And, you know, I think it's thought that the headaches, fever, like kind of the viral headache, fever, sometimes nausea, dizziness, maybe kind of like a meningitis type of presentation, because apparently there's melanin in your meninges. Who knew? Who knew?
The meningitis picture might be the CSF pleocytosis that we're also seeing if you so happen to get a spinal tap on these patients. But I think you're pretty hard pressed at this stage that anyone's really reaching for that unless you really are having meningismus and you wind up in like an ER or a primary care office.
Yeah, I can't tell you I've often reached for asking for an LP when I think someone might have VKH. Part of the reason is that the CSF, you know, pleocytosis meaning like, you know, elevated cell count, is usually fairly transient per the literature. So if they have, if they're going to have it, it might be only in this prodromal stage. And again, the prodromal stage tends to not have many ocular findings. Like they might be light sensitive. A little unclear to me whether that's, you know, a uveitis thing or is it more of like a meningitis thing where they're, you know, irritated by, you know, by bright lights, like photophobic. But, you know, they might have gotten an LP because of the systemic findings, you know, before they got to you. But I think that helps us move into the next stage, the acute uveitic stage. So this typically is, you know, maybe 5 days a week after they have a prodromal stage. So when, and this is probably when they're going to present to you the ophthalmologist. So the prodromal stuff is stuff you want to ask about historically, but you're probably not going to, you know, they may not have those symptoms still when they see you. The acute uveitic stage, again, it can be a bilateral granulomatous panuveitis. So they could have like, you know, all segments of the eye can have uveitic findings that are associated with granuloma. Amanda, do you want to point out anything specific to VKH that you may not often see in other granulomatous panuveitises?
Well, there are Dehlin-Fuchs nodules, which is specific to VKH, although you have to be careful that you're not getting those confused with Forster-Fuchs spots, which is something that always confused me when I was studying for OCAP. Yeah. The difference, of course, would be that in Dehlin-Fuchs nodules, you have these sub-RP granulomas, versus in the Forster-Fuchs spots, you have peripheral CNVM from high myopia.
Yeah. Like, and they'll look completely different. It's just, I think the confusing is the terminology, you know, because Dehlin-Fuchs, like, discovered many things with the eye and described, you know, and we named them after him, so.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Fuchs.
There's a lot of Fuchs. He was very productive. But, you know, Dehlin-Fuchs nodules, granulomas tend to look kind of like a yellowish, something under the retina. And then Forster-Fuchs spots are usually like a pigmented thing, like a CNVM that's scarred or something, or sometimes might have a hemorrhage associated with it. But they'll look completely different. Just the terminology, I've seen it get confused between the two. So in the early kind of acute uveitic stage, the patients can get choroidal thickening and then sometimes disc edema, but a lot of pan uveitises can give you both of those. But, you know, I tend to do B scans, you know, on these patients to try to help figure out, is there a choroidal thickening? But eventually their choroid will get thick enough that they'll also get subretinal fluid. And this is what the kind of classic presentation where, you know, you show it at the conference and people will immediately say like, oh, that looks like VKH, is they'll get little pockets of subretinal fluid. Like, I mean, it eventually can become like one big serous detachment, but earlier on they can have little blebs almost of subretinal fluid that you can see is kind of scattered through the retina. It tends to be more prominent in the posterior pole. And associated with that, an OCT finding is something called a bacillary detachment. So that's where the EZ may be attached and down on the retina, but there's fluid within the photoreceptor line. It's a very characteristic thing that is not quite pathognomonic for VKH, but if you see a patient with like a bunch of little pockets of subretinal fluid and you see this weird splitting on OCT, like VKH should jump to very high in your differential.
So the next stage is the chronic convalescent stage. And this makes sense, again, thinking about the attack on pigment, but this occurs several weeks later, can be several months later. And what you see in this stage is vitiligo, so loss of pigment in skin, poliosis, the cool rogue-like loss of color in your hair.
Rogue being an X-Men. Yeah.
I always thought she was awesome, but that's what I think of when I think of poliosis, and then depigmentation of the choroid. There's a sign with.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. No, I just, listeners who are following along may know that we released an albinism episode recently, and Andrew, I recorded that with Andrew, and he did not want to reference the X-Men. He was shy about that, but you have, I'm glad you went for it, because I actually didn't know what the hell you were talking about at first. I forgot the Rogue was it.
How did you not know?
I like know, but like I also it didn't spring to mind. I didn't know what the heck he was going for. So yeah. In case listeners didn't figure out along with me when they were listening to the albinism episode, that's the reference he was going for. anyways, back to VKH and like eponyms and stuff. But you were asking something, Amanda.
Yes, I was. I forgot though. Loss of pigmentation in the choroid is associated with a sign. Do you know what that sign is?
Yeah, in the choroid, the buzzwords you might see on your tests are sunset glow. The thought is, you know, if they have like a darker choroid, because these again tend to be kind of more, darker RPE, because these tend to be, more heavily pigmented patients, they'll have some depigmentation of their RPE and choroid, which can make it look like a brighter orange kind of choroid than they might have before before the attack. So that's what that sunset glow comes from. Again, it's all a melaninitis issue. And there's another sign on the anterior segment that is, you know, a big buzzword that they might test you on. What will we look for there, Amanda?
So it's called Sugiura's sign or perilimbal vitiligo. And this is actually something we talked about before we recorded this episode because it seems so subtle and so hard to see. But there is pigment in the palisades of void around the limbus. And you can lose that color that gives you this kind of whitish or poliosis or vitiligo, sorry, not poliosis, vitiligo around the limbus if you're looking very carefully.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, for junior residents, I think it's a good reason to get comfortable with what the normal limbus looks like. You know, you have to kind of like zoom in and really like look at the limbus to see the little bit of pigment that helps you see the palisades of void. You know, like without that pigment, you could hopefully see how it'd be hard to differentiate between the different palisades. And, you know, that's what this would look like, is there's like no subtle pigment between the palisades. So it becomes like hard to differentiate them. And it looks like, you know, a little bit wider than it would have otherwise, but very subtle finding. But a big buzzword that they might only kind of give you that as a clue that you need to answer the question in your test. So
You know, it occurs to me that Voigt was probably as productive as Fouque.
Yeah. Yeah, Voigt has a lot of stuff named. I think it's the same Voigt that did the Palisades of Voigt and, you know, VKH Voigt. I actually didn't look that up. I assume it's the same Voigt.
Or a prominent ophthalmologic family.
Yeah. It could be just, maybe it's a father-son thing or something, or father-daughter. I don't know. Just another thing, too, that goes along with this is that the trabecular meshwork can also get depigmented. So you might see that when you do a gonio on these patients. And then the last stage to know about is chronic recurrence. The definition is this would happen at least 6 months after kind of the acute uveitic stage. So sometimes they can get like another recurrence of this active, you know, uveitis after the initial one. It's not always that it just burns out. It can come back, which is why they need to be monitored.
So Ben, you mentioned earlier that there is one really big major differential you need to consider when you see someone that you think has VKH. What was that again?
Yeah, sympathetic ophthalmia, which as a reminder is when you have penetrating trauma, and it could be to either eye. Like the classic story is they have penetrating trauma to one eye and then like they lose function of it, or they it gets removed or something, but then the other eye sometime down the road gets a granulomatous panuveitis. So it's essentially indistinguishable because it's probably almost the same mechanism. You know, the penetrating trauma has to be fairly specific. So as surgeons, you know, we do penetrating trauma all the time when we do cataract surgery or like vitrectomies or tubes or whatever. But, you know, sympathetic ophthalmia is exceedingly rare. It really has to be the uvea has to be exposed to the conjunctiva, because that's where the lymphatic system is of the eye, and usually for some period of time. So like, yes, maybe a touch of uvea gets exposed to the conjunctiva when I do, you know, put in trocars for a vitrectomy, but it's like very little exposure and it's transient. You know, once we like come out with the trocars, there shouldn't be any more exposure. The cases that I've seen of sympathetic ophthalmia tend to be like the iris gets prolapsed out of the corneal wound, and maybe it's like unrecognized or something for like a week or two. And then, you know, sometime later, then they get sympathetic ophthalmia. So it's usually there has to be some duration of, like, or like the classic, more classic example is penetrating trauma to the eye, and then, you know, uvea sticking out of the eye because it's a ruptured globe and it makes contact with the conjunctiva. So that's what you're looking for in that history. Though in theory, I think there's been reports of like just a quote routine vitrectomy ending up with sympathetic ophthalmia. So like, don't totally rule it up. It's just quite unlikely. But again, the pathophysiology should make sense. It's similar because it's exposure with that like melanosomes or the RP or some antigen within there to the immune system. The immune system attacks it, you know, in either eye. But it usually, because I think it's more specific to the RP, don't get the systemic findings in VKH. There might be case reports of that happening, but I'm not familiar with those. So it should be more like a Harada syndrome where it's isolated to one eye or the other. And then I briefly mentioned, you know, I guess I'll just go into a little bit more if you're curious, checkpoint inhibitors. The idea is, you know, you prime something like, you know, T cells to attack. You know, melanoma is a classic one, though they're used for many solid cancer, solid tumors now. But because of that, it tends to have similar, when they get ophthalmic side effects, they tend to be somewhat similar to VKH. Because you're attacking melanoma, you might be attacking antigens also in the RPA, melanosomes, etc. So you can get like these multifocal, small, like blood-like serous attachments. If you're interested in hearing more about that, our sister podcast, Experts in Sight by the AAO, I will release an episode about this topic in like a couple months if you're interested in hearing more about that. So stay tuned to that podcast. Okay.
I can't wait to hear that.
Hopefully that wasn't too much, but
I think the only other comment I have is that sympathetic ophthalmia is a great reminder that the eye, the inside of the eye is very immune privileged. And so you have to be careful when that privilege is lost, when there's trauma and you get exposure of those contents, inner contents to the general immune system.
Exactly. You know, I think this episode's gone long enough. We won't go into super detail about treatment. The treatment's pretty similar to other panuveitises, like attack it early. Once you've ruled out infectious things, like, you know, we didn't go through the whole differential. Tuberculosis can present with similar things, you know, always think about syphilis with panuveitis, you know, but, you know, so always do your like total like infectious rule out for sure. And then look for other immune, autoimmune causes and do your full imaging workup and everything. But once you've ruled out infectious stuff, then you want to treat this aggressively. usually with high dose steroids, IV or oral, and then often they'll need, you know, long-term therapy with immunomodulatory therapy often, but not always. And yeah, I think that's what I'd want to know about VKH if I were about to take the boards.
Yeah, I think that covers it from what I remember of doing. I guess back then it was off the questions. I think there are more options now.
Yeah.
Shall we do a quick review?
Yeah, let's do a 2-minute review.
Okay, so the basics of the pathophysiology is that the immune system is attacking something related to pigment, so melanocytes, melanin, some sort of antigen, and don't forget that the eye has pigment too.
There are 4 stages. The first is prodromal. Well, they'll have viral, like, you know, type symptoms, headache, fever, nausea, dizziness, and then sometimes hearing problems like tinnitus and dysacusis. And if you did an LP, then they would have CSF pleocytosis, elevated cell counts.
The next stage is acute uveitic stage, and that's where we tend to see all the classic eye findings with the choroidal thickening, the multiple serous RDs, the granulomatous panuveitis, all the stuff that would make you very anxious if it walked into your clinic.
Eventually, they would tend to go into the chronic or convalescent stage where they get vitiligo, poliosis, and depigmentation of the choroid. The buzzwords to remember are Sugira's sign or perilimbal vitiligo, where there's vitiligo around the, you know, in the limbus, and sunset glow, which is the description of the color of the choroid.
And the last stage is recurrent. So this happens at least 6 months after, and you can get it all over again.
Don't forget about thinking about sympathetic ophthalmia as a differential, though there's other differentials for bilateral granulomatous panuveitis.
And in terms of treatment, you really want to be aggressive with that immune suppression. So high-dose steroids, whether that's IV or oral, and possibly they might need long-term immunosuppression.
Thanks, everyone, for your time and attention. We hope this was useful, and we'll see you guys next week. Bye.
Bye.